Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, artists go to war over venue merch commissions. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to be taking a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry stories of the last week. A week when we reached the 10th anniversary of the Wikipedia blackout and the takedown of Mega Upload.
Yeah, that was a big week in the music piracy record industry trying to crack down on online copyright infringement story. That's a catchy title for that story, isn't it?
Yeah. They don't call you the clickbait king for nothing.
Well, I've always been planning on writing a book about the music industry's battle against music piracy, so maybe I found the title for the book.
I mean, yeah, that would
stand out on Amazon, wouldn't it, if you could see that? Yeah, so 10 years ago, so this is only for old-timers, really. Do you remember? I posted
10
about...
10 years isn't that long ago.
It's not that long ago. It is true.
Also, none of this seems like 10 years ago either.
But... the era when things like getting web blocking into American copyright law sent the tech sector into a massive frenzy to the extent that Wikipedia stopped you accessing its English language version for 24 hours in protest. Meanwhile, Mega Upload was the big enemy of the music industry with its file transfer service and its YouTube clone. Although it's only 10 years ago, that does seem like a really quaint time now with hindsight. But those were the things that were bothering the music industry 10 years ago when it all kind of seems like, well, I suppose we should remind ourselves that in 2012, the record industry was basically at its lowest ebb revenues-wise. You know, there'd been 10 years of revenue decline by that point. The iTunes explosion had already happened, particularly in the UK and the US. iTunes was massive. It had slowed down the decline. So basically, record industry revenues were pretty much flat in the early part of the 2010s. Each year, the record industry made more or less the same as what it had made the previous year. But crucially, the iTunes boom, the arrival of YouTube, getting its licensing deals, the whole MySpace music thing, none of that had taken the music industry back into growth. So it was at its lowest ebb. And so that's why getting web blocking into American copyright law was such a big priority for the music industry. It didn't happen because, well, as we said, Wikipedia had a spat, threw its toys out of the pram and said, oh, web blocking would kill Wikipedia. I mean, we got web blocking here in the UK. It didn't kill Wikipedia, but that was what they were claiming in 2012. Mega Upload and Kim.com was a big enemy because I guess back then the record industry wasn't yet... I don't know, maybe some optimists were. The Spotify boom was already getting ready to, what does a boom do? Does a boom boom?
I guess so. The boom was booming, or about to boom. The boom was about to boom.
Do you know what? I was going through the archive of the CMU website for various reasons I won't bore you with recently, and I found a story. Actually, it's from a 3 years before 2012, 2009. And you know how in the olden days of CMU Daily, rather than having our one-liners news in brief that we now have pretty much every day in the CMU Daily, we just used to have lots of really short stories in the Daily, which were like one sentence long. That's a full story. And one of those sentences, I've even got it here because I thought it was funny. This was, you know, a little throwaway little story in the middle of the CMU Daily in the middle of 2009. It says, the former business development director of Yahoo Mobile has announced he is to head up the development of a mobile version of everyone's favourite streaming music service, Spotify. And back in 2009, when we were saying that, we were kind of being sarcastic, weren't we? Because Spotify was still really small in 2009. So we weren't being nice to Spotify and saying how great Spotify is. We're kind of being sarcastic. And so this ex-Yahoo guy revealed on his blog that work will begin on Spotify Mobile next month. No word on the specifics of how it will work yet. End of story. and in that two-sentence story was the beginning of the revival of the record industry because, of course, it was... I mean, you kind of forget that Spotify wasn't originally a mobile streaming service. You couldn't use it on a phone. Well, I guess when Spotify launched, had the iPhone even launched? But there was some dabbling in the mid-2000s of trying to bring music to sort of, you know, older phones, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was a bit of that. I had a phone pre-smartphones that you could play music on. I mean, it was, it was pre what we now know as smartphones. I suppose it would be a smartphone now. You could buy apps for it and stuff. It didn't work, but you could get apps. And you could play music on it, but probably only about two songs. I mean, I don't think it had a huge amount of space on it for that sort of thing. It wasn't really what it was designed for. Certainly, I didn't start really having music on my phone until I had an iPhone. So, yeah, but that was only, well, I suppose 2009. But, yeah, it still doesn't seem like that long ago.
Yeah, the idea, it's kind of weird to remember that when Spotify first launched, you listened to it on your computer. And that didn't seem weird at the time, because I suppose that's what we were used to. But yeah, so 2009, first report that Spotify is going mobile. So that played a big role in the whole explosion of subscription streaming. But that explosion hadn't happened properly by 2012. It was definitely underway, but still Record Industry at its lowest ebb. So that's why getting anti-piracy laws on the statute book in the US was a big priority. Not that it worked. Shutting down Mega Upload, I mean, whether or not that made any difference in the end. I mean, 10 years on, they still haven't got Kim.com, founder of Mega Upload, into court to face charges. He's still fighting extradition in New Zealand 10 years later. But it was kind of weird at the time that those two big events happened, because the Wikipedia blackout meant that web blocking did not become part of American copyright law, which was, in essence, a loss by the music industry in its battle against online piracy. And then 24 hours later, the American authorities come in and shut down Mega Upload, what seemed at the time a big win for the music industry. So it was an interesting week in the history of music piracy. But as we look back on it, I wrote a blog post on this, which I'm sure Andy will link to in the notes. As you look back, it does all seem kind of quaint in hindsight.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. Talking of short stories in the CME Daily, the one I always remember, and I think I was just trying to look for it. I think this predates having stories on the website when it was just the email. So it didn't matter so much that we had very short stories. But I always remember writing one where the headline was like, "The Killers announced new album titled," whatever it was called. And then I'd given all the information in the headline. So underneath I just put, "That's it."
An informative piece of journalism. In the old,
that's what they give me the awards for.
In the old fashioned, good old days of the CMU Daily, when we didn't care so much. But hey, let's be clear, we're not actually here on this edition of Setlist to talk about any of this nonsense.
No, later on we'll be discussing a new battle over Jimi Hendrix royalties. But first, the UK's Featured Artists Coalition has launched a new initiative to identify and champion the music venues that do not charge any commission on merchandise sales. It follows an online debate about those commissions last month that was sparked by a tweet from Tim Burgess of The Charlatans, who said, "Big respect to those venues that don't take a percentage of a band's merch sales. This isn't about The Charlatans, it's about those bands who need merch income to survive. Some places take 25%, a quarter of the full selling price. Vinyl doesn't even have that markup to begin with."
Yeah, and it was interesting when Tim Burgess posted that tweet and then all of the other tweets that were posted by artists in response, because I guess at the end of a year where most of the debate in the artist community and the wider music community was about how streaming money and digital income gets shared out, and obviously lots of people arguing that artists and songwriters don't get their fair share of that money, sometimes, maybe ever, all the time, who knows. But it was interesting to see the conversation flip to an issue on the live side of the business. Obviously, live was starting to get back going again at that point. I then hit another hurdle in mid to late December. But interesting to put a spotlight on something which I suspect quite a lot of music fans weren't even aware of, which is, it is pretty common in the music industry that when artists have a merch stall at their shows and fans are buying merch, that the venue where the merch stall is parked often takes a commission of the merch sales that happen. Although we should add, it is generally the larger venues, not the really small grassroots venues, that expect to charge a commission of that kind. So often as an artist, as you're working your way up the venue hierarchy, you often get to a point where suddenly the venue wants to take a cut of your merch sales. And I suppose it is for those sort of artists who are rising up the venue ladder you know, they're playing the slightly bigger venues, where it becomes a particularly big problem because they start playing the venues which are of the size where the venue charging commission on merch becomes more common. But those artists are often still not quite at the capacity where live becomes really lucrative with ticket sales alone. And until you reach the point where your capacities are bringing in loads of money through ticket sales, as an artist, there are basically three ways to make money out of your shows, which is the ticket money, also some PRS money if you are performing your own songs, and the merch store. And up until a certain point, artists require all three of those revenue streams for their live activity to be profitable. So as I say, you get these artists who start to play slightly bigger venues. That's exciting. Not yet playing big enough venues that the ticket sales and the fees they get from the promoters, et cetera, is a lot of money, really relying on merch. And then suddenly the venue wants, well, often like a 25% commission. So this has been a bugbear of touring artists for some time. It is worth noting that quite often what is happening with some of the bigger venues is it's not that the venue itself is actually routinely taking 25% out of the merch sales. What happens is the venues do a deal with merchandising companies. So then you have a company who have the rights to oversee merch sales in that venue. That company then often runs the merch stall, but then takes its 25% commission. And maybe those companies and venues would say, well, we're running the stall for you, so therefore, that's how we earn our 25%. But lots of artists would say, well, we don't think you're worth 25%. Plus, actually, if we have a member of our team manning the stall, or indeed some artists like to man their own merch stall, because we understand the artists and the fans, we can probably sell more. Whereas if you have somebody who works for a merchandising company who doesn't really know the band, they're probably not going to sell as much merch. Also, you know, cynics might say, artists would prefer to run the merch stall themselves, even in venues where there is a commission being charged, because then the venue doesn't actually know how much merch you've sold. So maybe you can do a little sneaky thing. I'm sure that never happens. I can't believe that happens. But yeah, this is an issue that has sort of been debated behind the scenes for quite some time. So it was interesting to see Tim Burgess talk about it in public and then to spark a conversation amongst the artist community.
Yeah, and Tim Burgess, when he was talking about this on Twitter last month, actually kind of referenced the fact that it is often a third-party merch company that's actually taking the cut. And he said, to be perfectly clear about this, often it's a completely separate concession company that the venue deals with as part of a contract. A kid who has never heard of the band sells our stuff while our merch person steps aside for the night. The whole system needs addressing. And once Burgess had kick-started that debate, other artists started airing their grievances about, you know, these merch commissions, with Peter Hook, formerly of Joy Division and New Order, being particularly vocal and getting into quite a lot of detail about it, saying, I've been arguing with venues, mainly larger ones, about this for years. Charging the bands 25% commission on the gross of anything sold makes having merchandise for most bands a total vanity project. Creating the artwork alone can cost £500 to £700. Then the printing and transport of most two-colour t-shirts normally cost between £6 to £8 plus VAT. Another thing that these venues refuse to do is take the VAT off the gross before they take a commission, which is actually illegal because the VAT belongs to the government. If we were to sell our t-shirts for £20 minus VAT, so £16, the venue is taking £5 per t-shirt. After the average cost of, say, £6, the bands are making £5 at most, he went on. Out of that £5, we then have to pay the seller and pay for transport, and some bands may also have to pay their management a percentage of that profit too. I think it goes without saying that if the commission came off the net profit rather than the gross, it would be much fairer. He also added, while obviously the band is getting a fee for playing, the venue makes a profit on the bar, the cloakroom, and sometimes even the car park. Their faces when you ask for a cut of that is priceless. This is a big problem within our industry, he continued, but while it inexplicably remains common practice, in my view it should be sorted out between the promoter and the venue before the band even get there. I've lost count of how many great gigs have been ruined by the same post-show argument over a few hundred quid when the show has actually turned over hundreds of thousands of pounds, which is, of course, far more than we were getting paid. And then commending Tim Burgess for raising the issue, Hook concluded, "You have my full support, and let's hope we can change things for the good of all artists."
Now, talking about changing things for the good, So the Featured Artist Coalition, the organisation for artists in the UK, has sort of taken this and run with it. FAC did actually raise merch commissions. So last year, they launched a kite mark scheme around gigging and venues and promoters. That was in partnership with another organisation called the Association of Independent Promoters. And as part of that, they did criticise venues taking fees on merchandise sales, saying that the imposition of punitive fees for selling merchandise, where those fees are not directly related to the cost of doing so, does not seem acceptable. So on the back of what they said as part of that last year, and then the conversation that happened online last month after Tim Burgess's tweet, so the FAC now are launching this new scheme, which basically, I mean, it's a really simple idea, but I think it's going to be quite effective, is to put together a database, a list, if you like, a directory of all the venues in the UK who don't take 1% of merch sales, okay? Who allow artists to set up a merch stall, sell whatever they like, and keep all of the money. And so that was launched last week. And basically, venues across the country are being encouraged to put themselves into that list and basically confirm to the artist community, to the music industry, and to fans that they are, well, FAC are calling them 100% venues. Venues that allow artists, when they sell merch, to keep all the money. The venues don't get involved.
So commenting on this new initiative, which is called the 100% Venues Directory, FAC CEO David Martin said, "These 100% venues are leading the way, enabling artists to take home 100% of merchandise revenue. This makes selling merchandise at gigs worthwhile for artists, creating a fairer and more sustainable touring circuit, particularly for grassroots and emerging talent." And then Peter Hook again chimed in and said, "You're treated like gods in the dressing room and then robbed blind on the merchandise stall. I fully support this campaign and have been very vocal about this injustice to artists and fans for years."
And especially last month, as we saw.
Yes.
Although I did think, I thought actually the post that Peter Hook made last month, although it was quite long and it was lots of JPEGs stuck to a tweet, but actually I thought it was good of him to sort of give the background of the costs and the hassle of creating the merch. It's a really important revenue stream for the artist, but it is a revenue stream that has a bunch of risk to it, particularly that whole thing around the VAT. So it was a nice detailed post that he sort of entered into the debate last month. Yeah, and good to see him getting behind this attempt by the FAC to solve this. So I'm sure Andy will put a link to that directory in the notes. And I guess if there are any venues listening in the UK who do not charge commissions on merch, who are not in that directory yet, get in there and add yourself. There's a simple form to fill out. And then once all of the venues have sort of, you know, well, all the venues who don't charge merch commissions have put their names on the list, then it will become a really good resource for artists when they're sort of, well, first of all, when they're picking venues to play. But also, I guess, even if what venues to play is out of an artist's control because the promoter is deciding, or maybe they're a support act or whatever, it would help them plan, won't it? I mean, when they're planning their tour and they're thinking, okay, I'm going to sell merch, will it help me break even on this tour? They can see ahead. That was another thing that Peter Hook talked about, wasn't it? Is sometimes it's not entirely clear you're going to be charged that commission until after the fact. So it will allow artists to decide which venues they may or may not want to play, and B, it will allow them to plan how much they're going to have to pay out on merch commissions if they are playing venues where those commissions apply, and have that in the budget planned out. So hopefully a successful initiative, both for getting a bit more transparency in the sector, and maybe ultimately, I mean, obviously those venues that have done like a 5-year deal with a merchandising company can't immediately act to remove the commissions, but maybe they'll find a different way of working with those companies long term. And all venues eventually will allow artists to sell their merchandise at their shows without having to give up any money to the venue or a third party.
And finally, on this edition of Setlist, well, we're used to talking about royalty disputes between artists, aren't we? Although this is an interesting royalty dispute because all three artists involved are dead. But so last week, the Jimi Hendrix estate and Sony Music filed legal papers with the courts in New York seeking a declaratory judgment that agreements reached with the other members of the Jimi Hendrix Experience in the early 1970s are still in force. So the move follows threats in the UK by the estates of those former Experience members, Noel Redding and Mitch Mitchell, to sue for supposedly unpaid royalties.
Yeah, so this disputes between three artists who sadly are no longer with us. So it's their estates fighting this out, as you said. But it all focuses on agreements that were reached actually after Jimi Hendrix's death. So following Jimi Hendrix, you know, very sadly premature death way back in 1970, I think I'm right in saying, you then had the other two members of the Jimi Hendrix Experience, and they agreed deals with the estate after Jimi Hendrix's death. It took a few years for those deals to be negotiated. So I think Redding signed his in 1973, Mitchell in 1974. And those deals had various elements to them. But I suppose the important thing, well, two important things for the purpose of the new dispute. First of all, as far as I can see, they received, both of them, one-off payments, or, in the word of the legal filing last week, significant monetary consideration. Think that means a lot of money. So they got one-off sizable payments and basically in return did two things. First of all, gave up any claim to rights or royalties in the recordings that they had collaborated on with Jimi Hendrix in the preceding years. So basically we take our money, we no longer are involved in these recordings, we don't even get royalties beyond any statutory remuneration through PPL or whatever. And then the other thing that they committed to in these agreements in the early 1970s was that they would never sue the Jimi Hendrix estate or any of its successors. So those are the agreements that are at the heart of this new dispute.
So according to the companies that manage the Hendrix estate, so that's Experience Hendrix and Authentic Hendrix, neither Redding nor Mitchell ever raised any subsequent issues with those agreements until their deaths in 2003 and 2008, respectively. And at various points, they actually collaborated with the Hendrix companies on various projects. However, last month, two UK-based limited companies representing the estates of Redding and Mitchell sent a cease and desist letter to the London office of Sony Music, that being the major label, which is the worldwide licensee of the recordings controlled by the Hendrix companies. And in the letter, the two estates basically claim rights in relation to the Jimi Hendrix Experience recordings, which they argue are being infringed by Sony through its exploitation of that music. And in their legal filing with the New York courts, the Hendrix companies and Sony say the claim letter acknowledges the Mitchell contract and Redding contract, but threatens legal action on the basis that these broad New York general releases and covenants not to sue are unenforceable against defendants, noting, among other things, that neither Sony nor our clients were parties to the release agreements. The claim letter threatens litigation on the basis that they are owed damages estimated in the millions of dollars going back to 1973. This filing from Experience Hendrix and Sony Music continues, and then notes that since 1974, neither defendants nor their estates have ever objected to or made any claims related to any rights in connection with the copyright or other rights or interests in the recordings or payments in connection with the recordings.
And with all of that in mind, you will not be surprised to hear, basically, the Hendrix companies and Sony want the New York courts to declare clearly that those 1970s agreements are both valid and enforceable. And therefore, these claims that are now being made by the Redding and Mitchell estates through this letter that they sent are, and I quote, without legal foundation. Such a judgment from the New York courts, Experience Hendrix and Sony said, will provide relief and terminate the insecurity that has been created by the recent claims and threats of litigation. So we're interested to see how the New York courts now respond. Of course, there are some complications here, given that it was implied in that letter that these two companies representing the Redding and Mitchell estates sent, if they are to sue for these allegedly unpaid royalties, they may well be doing that through the UK courts. But the 1970s agreements that Experience Hendrix and Sony want to enforce were negotiated and signed in the US. So we have a little bit of UK-US law stuff going on here. Although Sony and Experience Hendrix anticipated that, and they said in their legal filing last week, to the extent that there may be additional issues which implicate foreign law, it is beyond dispute that United States federal courts have the authority to resolve disputes which require the application of foreign substantive law, including, but not limited to, United Kingdom copyright law. Therefore, this court can conclusively rule on and affirm rights, duties, and obligations of the parties. is what Sony and Experience Hendrix reckon.
So we await to see how things progress in the New York courts and whether we get any legal action on this side of the Atlantic. And perhaps this is something we'll return to on a future edition of Setlist. We'll certainly come back to it in the CME Daily, I'm sure. But that is all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. Chris has made reference to various links that you might be able to find in the show notes throughout this episode. If you go to setlistpodcast.com or indeed look in your podcast player right now, you will find those show notes and those links. So if you want to look up anything we've discussed or anything we've made reference to, it'll all be in there, hopefully.
We'll also link through to where you can buy tickets to the next round of CMU webinars all about music business trends in 2022, which are happening in February. You should all sign up for those.
Okay, all right, we'll do that as well.
Good.
Why not? Don't forget to subscribe to the show if you're not already. Rate and review it if you haven't already, or even if you have. Email us if you want to, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Moulton and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.